And good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, September 10th. I'm Lisa Music, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, family seeks support after Idaho man's tragic death in sand collapse. As Harris, Trump take debate stage, Project 2025 will be a focus. And Round Valley Projects Development Group forms in Round Valley. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. The family of Dustin Hansen is asking for community support following his tragic death after a fatal sand hole collapse at Samoa Powerball Beach in Northern California. Hansen, an Idaho resident, passed away midday on Saturday, September 7th, after being in critical condition at a local hospital since the accident earlier in the week. Hansen's family shared that in a final act of kindness, Hansen donated his organs, allowing him to continue helping others even after his passing. To cover funeral expenses and bring his remains back to Idaho, where his children and family are waiting to honor his memory, Hansen's loved ones have created a GoFundMe. Quote, "Every contribution, no matter how small, will make a meaningful difference," end quote, shared a family member. The accident occurred on September 4th when a sand avalanche buried Hansen in a 6-foot hole he had dug at Samoa Powerball Beach. Despite first responders' efforts, including CPR and an airlift to St. Joseph Hospital, Hansen remained in critical condition before succumbing to his injuries. His wife, who was also trapped briefly, managed to escape and call for help. As of news time, the GoFundMe has raised $3,728 of the $8,000 goal. Turning to Mendocino, the newly formed Round Valley Projects met at the Library Commons in Covelo to discuss how they aim to strengthen environmental stewardship and vocational training opportunities in the community. KZYX's Jen Procacci brings you the details.
Last Tuesday, August 27th, I attended the Round Valley Projects development meeting at the Library Commons in Covelo. Round Valley Projects is a newly formed group that aims to address a lack of environmental focus, awareness, and vocational training, coupled with limited opportunities and access to nature, which is causing a disconnect and weakening of environmental stewardship in youth and in the community. This is hindering local development and neglecting the importance of understanding our histories, differences, climate change, geography, ecology, and conservation of natural resources in Round Valley. The group envisions building a culture of future leaders, educators, and problem solvers in Round Valley by focusing on the environment, food security, and community resilience, leveraging outside resources for collaborative management of ecological and social resilience, restoring local ecosystems through nature-based education, habitat restoration, outdoor activities, vocational skills training, and cultural revitalization, ultimately bringing the community closer to nature. The meeting was attended by 9 current and former residents of Round Valley, who form the core group dedicated to moving this vision forward. Projects that were identified at a public community visioning workshop a month ago were discussed. The proposed projects include a fire hydrant system for the downtown, development of the existing recreation center and expansion to a community park, salmonid habitat restoration and cleanup in conjunction with Eel River Recovery Project, Covelo Water District, Round Valley Indian Tribes, and Mendocino County, internships and education on woodworking and natural building in a possible partnership with Redwood Forest Foundation Incorporated, vocational program development, classroom garden expansion, and career fair expansion at the Round Valley High School. Moderator Candace Reynolds describes the group's process.
Make sure that we get a vision across, we get ideas across, we want to make these actions happen, and I need to know how to do this. So I put together a 2-hour workshop. From that, I put together all the ideas from that list. Those were all the ideas that everyone has contributed so far. We did have a meeting, it was a month ago. We'll start sharing all that information so that after meetings, whatever information that has been shared can be commented on, we can add to, you know, whatever everyone needs to do to, you know, make sure that their input is heard. So today I really, again, just thinking about these little steps forward. And so what I'd like to do today is thank everyone for being here and just being a part of this. This is just driving in here again today. It's just so beautiful here. It is so amazing. It's so easy just to get lost in all this. I mean, it's almost no words. You know, someone said, a friend said, just, you know, make sure you take pictures. And I said, well, it's breathtaking. I'm just going to have to take you sometime. I just really want to do whatever I can to help facilitate this process. And that's why I'm here. You guys have all the ideas. You guys have the vision. I just want to help, you know, move that along however I can, so you guys can build that capacity to, you know, do what you need to do for your community. So,
meeting participant Sarah shared her views on what makes Covelo so unique in terms of the opportunity for a connection with nature for the youth.
The opportunity to go out and involve yourself with nature, and Covelo by default being so small and sort of encapsulated in the valley, to be able to like really show the kids what a special environment they live in and how incredible it is. And that connection, because living, one of the things that I think Covelo and Round Valley has is that like ability to really solidify with their young this connection to the environment and natural. And I think that is one of the things that is so hopefully remarkable in having a group like this, because it comes from all angles. If there was a way to bring the kids to see that bigger forest and fish and rivers and just all of that, and then, so I'm just not sure that everyone's ready immediately. It's gonna take a minute. So that was my only comment.
We start to define some of the projects. One of the next steps is really looking at all these timelines and seeing, what are these projects that the readiness level is very high. This is something, 5-10 years down the road, and we'll be able to start to develop so that we can also kind of look at a glance at projects and see, what we have already, kind of those lowest hanging fruits, and then what needs to be developed further. And then everyone in their roles, can start to kind of figure out what's the best way to go about, to approach each of these ideas. So,
The group meets every last Tuesday of the month in the Library Commons. Time to be determined. For the KZYX News, I'm Jen Procacci.
In housing news, East Bay residents fight for housing rights. KPFA's Eileen Alvendary reports.
Hi. Hello, how are you?
I'm good.
Sounds like I'm meeting some of your family here.
Yes.
Marika Goolsby loves animals. She's the owner of the City Hikes dog walking and pet sitting business. Goolsby shares her East Oakland home with 4 dogs, 7 cats, 1 bird, and 1 fish.
So this is Kaboli, and this is Jackson, and the others are around.
Goolsby almost lost her home in 2017 when the nation's largest corporate owner of single-family homes, Invitation Homes, engaged in an $11 billion merger with Starwood Waypoint. That's the corporation that initially owned Goolsby's home. Invitation Homes said it would renew her lease for a year with a rent hike of $350 a month. Goolsby said she couldn't afford it.
I was panicking. I was already working the maximum that I could work. I was leaving my home before sunrise, getting home like 9:30 p.m. at night most days. And I said, it's impossible for me to work more hours. I mean, I really believed that I was going to end up living in my car with my pets.
Goolsby's story had a happy ending. The group ACE, the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, organized actions on her behalf. Invitation Homes ultimately backed down and agreed to a $50 a month rent increase. In 2020, the Oakland Community Land Trust bought the house, lowered the rent, and is giving Goolsbee the opportunity to buy the home herself one day.
And they said, would you be interested in owning it? I was like, yeah. Like, I never even imagined that I would ever one day be a homeowner.
Goolsbee's problems with Invitation Homes is not unique. Earlier this year, California Attorney General Rob Bonta announced a $2 million settlement with the company after allegations that it violated California tenant and price gouging laws by unlawfully increasing rents on about 1,900 homes. The tenants also got their money back. California Assemblymember Alex Lee is one of only five state lawmakers who are renters. He says there is a nationwide phenomenon of large corporations buying up existing single-family homes. Lee has introduced legislation to restrict the practice.
I introduced 2584, this AB 2584, to prevent large corporations from buying up single-family homes and converting them into rentals.
Lee represents Milpitas, North San Jose, and nearby cities. He says in certain regions of the state, the corporate practice of buying single-family homes and converting them to rentals makes it that much harder for would-be homeowners to purchase a home.
In metro areas are relatively cheaper than, say, the Bay Area. You have hardworking families that get outbid and outpurchased by all cash offers, by corporations. So on the micro scale, that individual competition gets harder too.
Lee's legislation would bar any corporation that already owns more than 1,000 single-family homes in California from purchasing additional houses. He says according to existing documentation, the legislation would apply to three companies, including Invitation Homes.
It's Invitation Homes, which has 12,000. So that's 12,000 single-family homes. If each of them are you know, roughly average worth $1 million, that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of money. We have Cobra 28 LP, sufficiently generic sounding LLC, which probably is related to another LLC, is 2,472 homes. And the other is JD Home Rentals, 2,063.
Berkeley State Senator Nancy Skinner has proposed separate legislation that would ban hedge funds and other corporate investment entities from buying or leasing single-family homes in California. San Diego Assemblymember Chris Ward has authored legislation to prohibit home builders from selling houses in bulk to institutional investors, a practice he says freezes out families from buying newly built homes. The National Rental Home Council, which represents the single home rental industry, did not return an email request by KPFA for comment. Although some regions of the state are more affected, the California Research Bureau says large investors currently own only about 2% of single-family homes in the state. Leah Simon Weisberg is the executive director of Movement Legal. It provides legal services to the housing rights group ACE. Weisberg says that turning housing into a commodity for corporate investors is the single largest contributor to unaffordable housing, whether for single-family homes or apartment units.
People are exchanging it on the stock market. And so when you've got such a large part of the market being, you know, existing simply to trade, it devastates the ability to have stable, affordable housing. Because the thing is, it's like to create something that people can invest in, you have to buy stuff, you know, whether it's, you know, in the old days, pork, or it's units of housing. So they're just putting packages together to get people to invest.
Doug Henwood is an economic journalist based in New York City and host of Behind the News, which airs on KPFA. He says he's not sure investment entities are worse landlords than other property owners, but he calls the move of private equity into areas of the economy like healthcare and housing alarming.
I think as an asset class, as a form of doing business, private equity really, really does need to be reined in. They are a bunch of marauders and thieves. And a lot of them are actually fairly conservative politically. They're often a lot of big private equity people or major contributors to the Republican Party. The most famous of all, Steve Schwarzman, the head of Blackstone, is a major contributor to the Republican Party. He was actually pretty close to Trump until the very last minute. So, you know, these are people are a malign economic, political, and social force.
The housing rights group ACE has advanced policy recommendations to address corporate ownership of housing. It says that rent control and just cause eviction laws should be expanded to cover single-family rentals. ACE says tenants should be given the first chance to purchase their home when it's being sold, and nonprofits and public agencies should be next in line. ACE also calls for public disclosure by large-scale owners of single-family rentals and a speculator's fee to cover the costs of tracking and monitoring the data and giving access to advocates. Housing advocates like Movement Legal's Leah Simon Weisberg also promote the notion of what's known as social housing, which is publicly owned and mixed income and not necessarily government subsidized.
Social housing is where the government directly funds housing that is intended just to provide housing. And it's a model that really every other democracy uses. I mean, I think many people refer to Vienna as one of the great models, but it's where you really take out the profit motive out of housing. And it can provide housing for people on a fixed income, but also middle class families as well. And that is really the most successful model internationally.
Assemblymember Lee has introduced social housing bills since 2021. This year's attempt would establish a social housing revolving loan fund within the state treasury to provide zero-interest loans to build housing to accommodate a mix of household incomes.
I'm a huge champion and the Select Committee Chair for Social Housing, which is to have the state get into the business of developing housing, publicly developed mixed-income affordable housing across the state. I have a bill this year, which is my third attempt at it, AB 2881, which would create a statewide developer to build out the affordable housing.
Lee says last year's legislation passed with two-thirds majorities in both the California Assembly and State Senate. Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed it, citing budgetary reasons. Meantime, Marika Goolsbee says her experiences have led her to action. She joined the statewide housing rights group ACE and serves on its board. Goolsbee is an alternate on the Oakland Rent Board, and she's running for city council in District 7. She urges others to get involved, too.
Now I'm involved in housing issues. My wife is involved in environmental justice, so now I'm involved in that. Find out what's going on around you and get involved. And I know a lot of people say, oh, I don't have time, I don't have the energy. But it is worth it to make the time and find the energy, because being involved in these things, you can actually change what's going on in your community, in your life, in your neighbors' lives.
For KPFA News in East Oakland, I'm Eileen Alfandari.
A new study suggests that partisanship is less pronounced in local races when a particular local issue is deeply felt by voters. Suzanne Potter reports.
Researchers from Sacramento State and San Diego State Universities asked more than 900 partisan voters about housing and homelessness, then asked them to choose, in a hypothetical local election, between a candidate from their party who disagreed with their views or one from an opposite party who is aligned with them on policy. Sacramento State Associate Professor Danielle Martin co-authored the study.
Overall, voters do support candidates from their own party, even when an opposite party candidate was closer to their views. But we also found that about 40% defected from their party. So instead of picking the co-partisan candidate, they picked the candidate that aligned with their preferences on one of those local issues.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
In national news, KPFA's Scott Baba spoke with Chris Hare, an associate professor of political science at the University of California, Davis, about the impact presidential debates usually have on the race for the White House and what the two candidates will need to do to move the needle.
What kind of impacts do debates generally have on presidential races?
Usually very little. The standard finding that we've reached, and you know, to the best we can study these kinds of questions, and it's tough because there's a lot of other things going on simultaneously, of course, but the standard finding in the literature is presidential debates don't matter that much. Most of the people that are watching it
are already committed, right? The partisan cheerleader for one side or the other. And the other thing is usually most candidates are evenly matched. When they're not evenly matched, one candidate has a good night and the other has a bad night. For example, Mitt Romney had a really good performance. Obama had a really poor performance in the first debate of 2012. There's a bounce, but it comes back to earth, right? And so it's a sort of more of a temporary blip that the numbers can move, but then they sort of return back to where they were in the first prior to the debate. Now, a couple things that are, of course, different about this year is that, one, it's such a close race that conceivably anything can matter. So even if debates don't matter that much, if it's half a percentage swing, that might be enough to change the course of the election. And of course, the other thing is that Kamala Harris is, it's a weird situation. It's almost like in the national eye, instead of going through months and months of primaries, right, her campaign is less than 2 months old. So the ability for her to change her image, either for good or bad, is greater than for most presidential candidates at this stage of the game, where things are much more frozen and limber.
So, I mean, I guess, is there anything either candidate you think needs to do to make a difference?
I think it's to find Harris. I mean, I think Trump, you know, after 8 years, that is pretty much set. I mean, of course, this is barring anything, you know, that Trump says something that for whatever reason is enormously controversial or comes up with some new policy proposal that's really large and kind of out of nowhere. And that's, of course, is all possible. But Trump's image is sort of like he's a known quantity at this point. The biggest thing for both sides is defining Harris. And of course, Trump wants to define Harris in a certain way. And then Harris wants to define herself in a very different kind of way. But that's what I presume is going to happen, that Trump is going to try to paint Harris. And right, he's been trying out a whole bunch of different lines of attack, hasn't found one that seems to be really successful. But, you know, it may well be California radical, you know, weak on immigration, weak on crime, ineffectual, inflation. I expect those kinds of issues and talking points. Of course, Trump is going to want to play up her role and stature in the Biden administration, trying tire to the Biden administration, especially on policies like inflation and immigration and the border. Of course, Harris is going to try to do something very different, which is here's a new set of policy proposals, a new vision, a new image. She's in a tough position because, you know, on the one hand, the central theme of this campaign, of her campaign, has been right joy, right? Joyous and sort of this optimistic, more hopeful kind of approach for America. At the same time, she's a prosecutor, and she's almost certainly going to want to hit Trump hard, right, in a prosecutorial way, which is not especially joyful. And so that's going to be a really tough balancing act, I think, for her to try to mediate between being this sort of happy warrior, but also, you know, coming after Trump in a fairly targeted prosecutorial or at least adversarial kind of way.
If debates generally only give small temporary bumps, at this stage in the election cycle, what do candidates need to do to increase their outreach?
Well, yeah, and this is the classic question, and it's as relevant this year as any other, of the tension between turning out your base and winning over swing voters, or, you know, winning over undecideds, or even, of course, winning over converts from the other side. I think with this race now, and it seems like Harris has kind of pitted back in equilibrium, which is this should be 50-50, right? All of Trump's races have been very, very close. And right, the idea that he would either run away with it or get blown out, you know, and he was trending towards running away with it in the summer. You know, Trump, of course, is in this tough position that he has a very high floor, but a relatively low ceiling, that, you know, even after the assassination attempt, he was really never able to get above 50%. And it looks like if Trump has a road to victory, it's not going to be in blowout kind of fashion. On the other hand, he's probably not going to lose by a blowout. And so, you know, I think they're both going to want to get these viral moments in, of course, to fire up the base. Of course, that's also what sticks around the news cycle. I mean, to the extent that debates can matter, sometimes they do, sometimes it's not just temporary, it usually is, but sometimes it's a little bit more lasting. An example would be 2000, Al Gore, right, that he exaggerated some things, and Bush's campaign was able to tie that into a pattern of, you know, Al Gore is just not trustworthy, right? There's just something that's not genuine about him. And so the debate in that situation almost certainly mattered. Again, though, that was a race of 537 votes in Florida. This could well be, you know, 5,000 votes in Wisconsin or 10,000 votes in Pennsylvania or something. So I think that's the other consideration, is that you want to be able to fire up your base, especially if you're someone like Trump. I think Harris's base is already there, right? She has the momentum, came in with a huge head of steam. I see her as trying to win over converts a little bit more, and I see Trump as trying to shore up his base, his turnout, because there just aren't a whole lot more votes out there for him. At least it doesn't seem like it. It just doesn't seem like there's a huge pool of voters that are going to vote for him. What he needs is to regain the momentum and fire up his base, which is what he sort of, his inclinations seem to be that anyway. He's perfectly comfortable with having 48% of the country.
All right. Well, Chris Hare, Associate Professor of Political Science at UC Davis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Anytime, Scott.
In other debate news, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump will be speaking to voters across the country tonight. One of the differences that'll likely be highlighted are policy proposals, including the right-wing playbook called Project 2025. Alex Gonzalez brings you the details.
The highly anticipated debate between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris is tonight. And as Election Day inches closer, more attention is being placed on the role toss-up states such as Nevada will play. Harris has launched an issues page on her campaign website outlining a number of her policy decisions and how they differ from Project 2025, a controversial policy playbook issued by a right-wing think tank called the Heritage Foundation. While Trump has tried to distance himself from Project 2025, it's proved to be quite a challenge since many influential Trump loyalists and allies are behind it. Julie Milliken, with the nonprofit Media Matters for America, says the Heritage Foundation has a proven track record of success.
They have consistently gotten the majority of their mandate for leadership proposals implemented by incoming Republican administrations, again, going back to Reagan.
Milliken says that in the first year of the Trump administration, the Heritage Foundation touted that more than two-thirds of their mandates were enacted under Trump. She says that speaks to why Project 2025 has to be taken seriously, which would revamp or completely eliminate certain federal agencies, such as the Department of Education and the National Weather Service. The debate will be hosted by ABC and will start at 6 p.m. Pacific time. Milliken considers Project 2025 to be what she calls expansive and extreme, which she says can lead voters to feel overwhelmed. In her perspective, Project 2025 boils down to an agenda of wanting control over many aspects of everyday life.
There are strict definitions of who it is that can be married. There are strict definitions about what women's role is, which is primarily just to have children and raise children, and outside of that, they don't have a lot of other worth.
Milliken encourages voters to contrast Project 2025's proposals with their own personal values, as it can be an easier and more effective way to determine the impact the playbook could have on the things that matter most to them. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. And thanks to our reporters, Jen Procacci, Eileen Alfandary, Suzanne Potter, and Scott Baba. KMUN News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.